Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's as simple as this. You cannot claim to be worried about violence at universities, about disruptions to students' education, about safety on college campuses, and ignore what is taking place in Gaza. And you cannot be more concerned about the act of students protesting than you are with the very issues that they're protesting against.
Hey, everybody. Welcome into an all-new episode of Can We Please Talk podcast. As always, I'm Mike Leon.
And not working on my diss track, I'm Nick Sperry.
Oh, geez. That's the second biggest story happening right there between Drake and Kendrick Lamar. Let's talk about the first one on the program today, Nick. College campuses all across the country are approaching graduation, and that's not at all what's been happening across these campuses, from UCLA to Columbia University to even our alma mater, Nick, Rutgers University. We're going to weigh in on the protests that have been happening all across college campuses throughout the U.S. and the why, which is getting lost in all of this. Why these protests are happening in the first place. Plus, later on in the program, former CNN political analyst, speechwriter once upon a time for Mayor Rudy Giuliani in New York. That's right. I said that sentence. He's an author, historian, a former editor in chief. The man at one time had way too many jobs. Well, now he's trying to land a big job as congressman of New York's first district out in Long Island. John Avalon joins the program to talk about his campaign, his message to voters, why he left TV to do something bigger. All of that coming up on the other side of the break. A great interview with our buddy John Avalon. And like I mentioned, if you want to find out more about him, go to johnavalon.com and go read up everything about John and what he's doing out there in District 1 in Long Island. Some housekeeping notes here before I say hello to my buddy Nick Sperry. All new episode of Back Your Play with Q is out there over on leonmedianetwork.com or listen wherever you get your pods. Q gets you set for the second round of the NBA playoffs. We saw a fantastic game between the Nuggets and the Timberwolves this past weekend. The Knicks beat the Sixers in six. So I'm very happy. Obviously, we move on to play the Indiana Pacers. All of that and more. Q's got you covered. All new episode of Back Your Play with Q is out there over on leonmedianetwork.com or listen wherever you get your pods. Also, an all-new episode of Ask the Experts is out there. You can go listen to it wherever you get your pods over on leonmedianetwork.com. The Ryan Garcia-Devin Haney fight recap, a huge win for Ryan Garcia, but it may get thrown out after he tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs. Curran breaks it all down as boxing journalist Eric Raskin joins the podcast. Plus, Curran also had the man who refereed the fight between Haney and Garcia, Harvey Dock, on his show to discuss some of the rulings that happened in the match. If you saw this pay-per-view, it happened in Barclays Center over in Brooklyn. It was a fantastic fight. All the buzz and the talk was about this fight that just happened a few weeks back. You can download the Ask the Experts podcast or listen to it on leonmedianetwork.com. Lastly, an all-new episode of the Educate US podcast is out there. Assessment testing in the world of education. Nick, Stacy, Patrice, welcome back in. Akil Bello to the program to discuss all of that and more. Go listen to my co-host as he moonlights over on the education show over on leonmedianetwork.com or listen wherever you get your pods. All right, now I say hello to my buddy Nick Saveri. Nick, you and I have been texting about this, about the college campus protests have been happening. I've been doing a couple TV segments on it because obviously it came to Rutgers University. And we're going to get into it in just a sec. But first, before we even talk about our days rummaging the old college campus at Rutgers University. And by the way, I'm going to point out something that kind of happened on our campus that was similar when we were going to school. And I don't know if you remember, but we'll talk about that in a sec. But how are you doing? How's everything going your way over there in Easton?
You know, things are good. The big headline for us is we just got a dog. So
that's right.
So our new member of the family, his name is Storm, came here on Wednesday. So just adjusting to life. So even as I do this show, I'm aware of where his crate is and, you know, mindful how much noise I'm making, so that obviously he's got to get to bed. So it's a change for all of us. So essentially for our two little girls, you know, recognizing that, you know, with another member of the family and the dog's little, he's only about 12 weeks old. You know, everyone has to step up a little bit. You know, if you're the oldest kid of two, well, now you're the oldest of three. And yeah, everyone's got to step up. Responsibilities have to get distributed. So, you know, so it's a welcome change, but with it comes obviously a great responsibility. So we're just adjusting, but we're happy as well. I've noted that, you know, we've had such an affinity for the dog and having a dog around the house. It's made me wonder a little bit of, as much work as it is, you know, should we have done something like this sooner? Because he's just definitely brought a really positive energy to the house, and I definitely appreciate the companionship. So all is well in Easton. How goes things in Miami?
You know, everything's going well right here. I can't complain too much. We got some news coming out soon. If you don't follow, not for Can We Please Talk, but for the podcast network and the network overall, some news coming out later this week of some stuff we're going to be doing in live sports and entertainment, a partnership that we have coming up with not only a network, but also something in the sports realm. I alluded to it when I did some of the reads before. So follow us over on LinkedIn, Leon Media Network. Go to leonmedianetwork.com and you can read more about this press release that'll be happening this week. We record, Nick and I, Sunday nights, right? So you got this episode. If you listen to us on a Monday morning, it'll be tomorrow. If you listen to us on Tuesday, it's today. I'm excited about that and this partnership that's going to be coming and the work that's going to be coming in for the network and visibility and stuff like that and stuff we'll be doing in the sports space. So get ready, Nick, for a little bit of Leon Media Network and some combat sports here and some tickets that will be coming with that as well. So let's get into our first segment, Nick, because, you know, all of the seriousness that we should be devoting to what's happening at college campuses all around the country, all these different schools from Brown University, Columbia University, our alma mater, Rutgers University, as you see the helmet, if you're watching us on YouTube over my shoulder, to UCLA, USC, the University of Texas, every school, it felt like Northwestern, University of Chicago, was impacted by campus protests that were happening over the past few weeks. And obviously, anti-war demonstrations, some people call them pro-Palestinian demonstrations. There were some pro-Israeli demonstrations as well. There was clash amongst protesters. There's the president of the United States coming out and giving a statement to the American people about all of these protests. We're going to get into all of that in just a second. But what I did want to talk about is the why. The why we're having these protests happening. Because the protests right now, and you heard the clip at the beginning of this with our buddy Ayman Mohideen from MSNBC, and it's a little personal to him. Obviously, he's covered conflicts in Gaza before, so I get why he is saying that. But there's a why behind all of this. It's not that people are just showing up at campuses all over America for no reason. They're showing up for a reason. There's a war happening right now in the Middle East. There's another one happening in Ukraine. The one that's happening in the Middle East, you know, was not because of October 7th, but was heightened by October 7th because of what happened with respect to the attack on Israel, 1,200 plus folks that are dead. There's still 133 hostages that are still remaining. There's no end in sight for those families of those hostages. But we can't overlook what is happening in Gaza right now. And the over 30,000 or so folks, with almost 12, 13,000 of them being children, all being killed by different missile attacks, drone attacks, whatever it is from the Israeli army. And this is the why that these folks are on campuses protesting. So I want to talk a little bit about this today, Nick, and let's look at it holistically, and then let's break it down as best as we can. As we were former students once upon a time at Rutgers University, around the time that 9/11 happened, and then it got into the Iraq War. And so there were protests happening in and around those same events. Now, again, a little bit different. That was an attack on our soil and obviously what our government did in response. But we have at least a reference point of when we were students. I can't believe it was 20 years ago that I'm saying this. But first, let's get into the media's coverage of all this. If you haven't been watching or paying attention to the way different protests have been covered across the media, take a listen or watch this.
Each day come the reinforcements, more supplies, and more demonstrators. The growing protest camps, like this student protest encampment at City University of New York, include Jewish Americans on both sides of the barricade. This man, who said he was an Israeli soldier who just served in Gaza, said he wanted to open a dialogue with protesters.
As an IDF soldier who fought in Gaza, to have the opportunity to have the conversations and let people know the side of the IDF that maybe they don't know, that we do want peace, that we do care about Palestinians, that we do care about Muslims.
Those who came to show their support for Israel say the pro-Palestinian point of view has received more than its fair share of attention on college campuses lately. They say what's not being discussed are the hostages who were kidnapped from Israel, who have been held in tunnels underneath Gaza for more than 200 days.
It's incredibly sad and heartbreaking that there have been innocent lives lost on both sides, but the 133 remaining hostages are not being spoken up for in a loud enough way.
Hundreds of DePaul students have joined the growing tent encampment in Lincoln Park. Protest leaders have been meeting with university officials, but say they won't leave until their demands are met. Encampments are also growing at the University of Chicago. The demands there are the same: divestment from companies that support Israel and the war in Gaza, and disclosure of where the U of C is spending its money.
46 overall campuses, 2,400 plus arrests so far across since April 17th. Now, again, obviously, we're into May right now, and graduations are starting up all around all these college campuses. So there's probably way more. And there's probably folks, and again, as I was saying this to a friend of mine recently, college campuses are open, you know, like they're open spaces. At Rutgers, you know, we were in the middle of five different cities. So you could just drive through a campus, and let's say you saw a protest happening and you wanted to join that protest. Doesn't mean necessarily you're an agitator, or it doesn't mean that you partake or in the protest, whatever it is, but you could drive to the campus and park on campus and join a protest. So you're going to always see people that are not students of the school being able to participate in a protest. That's because colleges are not gated communities. They're open to the public for you to be able to go there. That's how campus tours happen and stuff like that. Like, so I've always laughed at that sentiment of people like, well, these are folks that don't go to the school. Yeah, well, Columbia University is in Manhattan. So like, of course, it's in a major city. Like they, you can walk around and I could easily join a Columbia protest if it just happened to be up the block from where I was getting, you know, a bagel from a deli. So anyway, and I wouldn't get a bagel from a deli. But anyway, so I say all that to say that these campus protests are starting to take the attention, or at least for the last couple of weeks, we're taking the attention away from what's actually happening out in Gaza. Why these protests are happening is because of the war, because of Bibi Netanyahu's government right now and the Israeli military strategy, or maybe lack thereof, some people would say, in terms of what they're doing in Gaza. Leveling buildings, campuses, universities, as you heard Eamon say in the clip before. And what these protests are central root of, or at least the root, what they're trying to get to, is to get universities to divest from Israeli funds or exchange programs or whatever it is. We're going to get into some of the campus demands in a second, the demands of these protesters on these different campuses, because it's a little weird, and the messenger is terrible. The message is being lost in all of it, but the messenger is terrible. We're going to get into that in just a sec. But let's listen real quick, Nick, to what the president said last week about all of these campus protests. Take a listen.
We've all seen the images, and they put to the test two fundamental American principles. Excuse me. The first is the right to free speech and for people to peacefully assemble and make their voices heard. The second is the rule of law. Both must be upheld. We are not an authoritarian nation where we silence people or squash dissent. The American people are heard. In fact, peaceful protest is in the best tradition of how Americans respond to consequential issues. But, neither are we a lawless country. We are a civil society, and order must prevail. Throughout our history, we've often faced moments like this because we are a big, diverse, free-thinking, and freedom-loving nation. In moments like this, there are always those who rush in to score political points. But this isn't a moment for politics. It's a moment for clarity. So let me be clear. Peaceful protest in America. Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is. It's against the law when violence occurs. Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not peaceful protest. It's against the law.
All right. So, Nick, let's start first with just our initial takeaways on all of these protests that are happening. We touched on it a little bit. The why is getting lost in all of this. The war that's happening in Gaza, Israel's response, the hostages. By the way, I feel for the families of these hostages. As I see them go on television, shout out to our buddy Jake Tapper on CNN, who has had a lot of the families on his show. Brett Baer on Fox as well has had them on to really continue to shed light on. We're losing sight of, there's 133 people that are still over 7 months now being, you know, detained, kidnapped from their homes, from their families. And there's no end in sight for that, because as the latest reporting goes out to show, that Hamas and Israel have ended their potential ceasefire talks. I think Hamas has pulled out of the deal. So that is not going to happen. And Israel says they will continue their operation. And continuing their operation is at the central cause of why these protests continue to happen. Because as they continue to kill more and more people in Gaza, more and more folks here in the U.S. are continuing to voice their concern. And we're going to get into some of the polling on President Biden. Both groups are not happy with him. How is that going to affect him come November? I mean, we're only five, six months away from that. So we'll find out. But high level, your thoughts on the campus protests, the why they're protesting.
Yeah, I mean, this is very akin to it seems like a reaction similar to what we saw from college students in the Vietnam War. You know, you have young people that are angry. And I think part of this also is the fact that, and we've noted this before, you and I are not really excited about the rematch, you know, for the presidential election. And I think younger people even feel more disengaged. And, you know, for them, there's really no option. There's no viable choice. And there's anger in that. At the same time, you have a country in the U.S. that, for these young people, they would argue is continuing to support the IDF and the Israeli government, which they don't agree with. So it makes sense they're unhappy. And where I get a little fuzzy with this is, okay, so you have people who are unhappy. They're college students. They choose to protest on campus. And I understand making your voice heard, but in the matter of a foreign conflict that does not involve the U.S., at least in terms of direct activity, I mean, trying to protest to make sure that the United States no longer sends weapons to Israel, that takes a different tone with the Israeli government. I'm not sure what protesting on your campus necessarily does for that. So I'll give you an example. So I think about lunch counter protests, you know, that were staged by African Americans in the South. Peaceful protests in an effort to raise awareness for the fact that they were the victims of segregation. This affects them directly. Peacefully, they stay where they are and they refuse to leave until they are escorted out by the police. But there was an effort to make sure that these businesses that engage in this type of practice eventually are held accountable. Now, eventually, along with the Montgomery bus boycott, there was a groundswell of momentum, which eventually helped get laws changed. Eventually laws changed, the Civil Rights Act. But early on, it was just the recognition that Black people were fed up. This feels a little bit different, though. It feels a little like Occupy 2.0, where the purpose of Occupy Wall Street was to try to raise awareness to the fact that, you know, the business sector of the United States can be corrupt and not necessarily be a good thing. And people are angry about it. And this is also due to like the 2008, you know, economic collapse. But in the end, years removed, and we're now almost 20 years removed from that movement. Does anyone really know what specifically they were angry about? And I thought about that. That's actually what I wrote on my piece of paper when I was thinking about this episode today. Occupy 2.0 was sort of a header I wrote. And I wonder if we're going to run into the same thing. We understand that, you know, these young folks are angry about the actions of the Israeli government. They're angry the fact that our government isn't, by our activity or lack thereof, stands in support of the IDF. Where this rings a little hollow is that there's no recognition about Hamas's role in where we are at this point. So it seems very one-sided. Now, there's a very big question of the presence of anti-Semitism and to college students on these campuses who feel that as Jewish students, they feel unsafe. Well, that's a real thing. I mean, it's 2024, right? We're recognizing the need for safe spaces. So you have students who feel that this outcry potentially feels like a threat to them. Well, their voices should be heard. In terms of the president talking about free speech, I shake my head because this is, again, if you're on a college campus and you decide to act a certain way, and Mike's nodding his head because he knows exactly where I'm going to go with this, the college doesn't necessarily need to keep you.
Yep.
You want to go ahead and make your words felt, that's fine. But understand that at that point, the institution has a decision to make. And we are in the month of May. We are in the course of getting ready for graduation. USC, the young lady who had been nominated or who earned, valedictorian, is not going to be giving her speech, you know, her commencement address, because it's very clear that she has a very pro-Palestinian stance. And the university feels that it's not necessarily the safest move to let her speak. We can all be upset by that. At the same time, we also have to understand that the University of Southern California has a right to do what it does. If you're not happy with that, well, if you're a sports fan, don't support USC football. If you are an alum, stop sending your money. If you are a prospective student, don't go there. There's ways to make your words felt. These protests, these encampments at these campuses, it feels to me like an outpouring of outrage, which in its emotional sentiment, I understand. But what is the hopeful outcome of making your voice felt in this way? I understand there's a point about, well, maybe the school will divest its relationship to Israel. Are these students completely sure how that relationship works financially? Right. I mean, I'm not. So, like, is that the end game here? Like, I want our university to be dissociated with it from Israel. And that being said, are you associating the country of Israel with the IDF, with the prime minister? Because I think there is a little bit of a separation. I'm not a fan of Benjamin Netanyahu. Does that mean I look at Israel, you know, completely not favorably to the point where I would want to have no relationship with them? I question that a little bit.
Right. I think the biggest thing for me
is, and I've always said this, right? Well, first off, Nick and I never served in any government positions. We never served on any, you know, foreign policy trips, right? None of us worked for the State Department. None of us worked for the Department of Defense, nothing like that. So you would get two lay people's opinions here. All we have to bring to this is that Nick has worked in education for a long time, and we both happened to attend that campus where one of these protests was happening at, right? And I made the comparison before because, you know, 9/11 happened when you and I were students at Rutgers. I believe I was a sophomore, rising junior or something like that. And you, I think you were a senior or something like that. So either way. But the point was, then we got into the Iraq war, you know, within a couple years of that, where I was still on campus. And you saw a lot of protest around that. But I'm putting myself back in 18, 19, 20 year old shoes, because we're going to play a clip in a second of a PhD student at Columbia University and some of the things that she was saying about what she wants the university to do in terms of helping them with these protests, which is asinine. And we're losing sight of the overall message. But putting myself back in 20 year old Mike Leon's shoes, I don't know anything about this. I don't know enough to say what is right, what is wrong. Even like you said about divesting, and we've asked, we've reached out to Rutgers University to have President Holloway on, or somebody from the school that was acting in an administrative way, you know, towards working with the protesters on. So we will be doing something on that coming up soon, but it will be more, you know, again, as these protests are starting to quell, like it's a little bit more about looking at future and talking about how do we allow speech at college campuses? Because like you said, you violate the code of conduct. See you later. Like, this is very simple. So 20-year-old Mike Leon, do I know exactly why I'm protesting out there? No, probably not. But the biggest thing is, and what we're losing sight of, is there's a reason why all of these things have been organized. This is not each individual college that's doing this. This is organized. And then there are people that are carrying this out on the ground. And then there are students that are involved in it. But they're protesting for a specific reason. There's a war happening right now that's killing thousands of people, including innocent children. We've had so many different people talking about Palestine, Israel, the relationship, the war, the conflict, you know, over time. Historians, authors, journalists that are covering it. We've done a lot. We will continue to do a lot about it. But at the end of the day, you can't refute numbers, folks. And even if you took away half of them, you still have thousands of people and a makeup of a country with, you know, well, not really a country, a territory, let's call it 2.2 million people. And everyone says almost half of the population is under 18 years old. So that means there's a lot of children that are in harm's way. And we should all be on the side of not killing children. How we go about that in the country right now that's supplying weapons to the country that's doing the bombing and supplying aid to the country that's getting bombed is why they're out there. This is real simple. Like, they're out there for that specific reason. Now, I don't want to belittle anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, how people feel on campuses. If you don't feel safe, call campus security. For sure, the administrations have enough to deal with on their plate of how they keep students safe. And I'm in agreement, and I think you are too, Nick, with President Biden about the protesters. Listen, violence, clashing, all of that is wrong. The false equivalency is being made on some networks, like Greg Gutfeld talking about this is January 6th. You know, it's not the same thing, Greg. You know that that is not the same thing. This is not January 6th. January 6th happened because one guy thought that he won. He actually lost. And then all of these bozo people went to government property and destroyed it, smashed it. It's not the same thing. OK, they smashed government property. If I smash government property right now, I would be shot or arrested. That's the way it works. This isn't rocket science. You know better. Or maybe you don't, because the money is being made off of you pretending that you don't know better. So either way, the false equivalency of comparing this to the 1930s. I mean, our buddy Alex Clement at G-Zero Media wrote a fantastic piece criticizing Dana Bash from CNN and some other folks that have drawn this comparison of what's happening at college campuses to what's happening, you know, in the 1930s. And I want to just read one little thing that he said, because he spoke with a woman recently at the United for Israel march at Columbia. And she said the school itself had become like 1939 Germany. And I don't say that lightly. And Alex wrote, and I don't say this lightly either. Get a hold of yourself. And I agree. Get a hold of yourself. These are peaceful, for the most part, protests that are happening at college campuses. Okay. There haven't been any deaths, right? And these are folks voicing their opinion over a war that's happening. And we're seeing the votes in the primaries of this uncommitted vote of people that are not supporting the current administration's policy and handling on this. This is not the same as Jews being rounded up and killed in the 1930s and going into the 40s in Germany. I mean, if you don't get that, allow my historian friend Nick Zavarri to explain it to you for a second. Go ahead, Nick.
So, again, I mean, if you are a Jewish student or a citizen and you're by these protests and it feels as though that because of your faith, you feel targeted. Well, that's how you feel. And that's fine. That's warranted. You know, this comparison to the 1930s, you have to understand that part of the activities in that time is it led to a political movement. It was in support of Nazism, which is National Socialism. You know, these same people that led these protests made sure they also voted, which is something in this country young people sometimes aren't the best with. And it's what allowed for enough presence of National Socialists in the parliament, so much so that they were able to have one of their own eventually become chancellor. And that, of course, is Adolf Hitler. These protests we're seeing on college campuses right now, while it is against the state of Israel, it's not intended to try to bring issue with Jewish people. It's not an effort to try to have government policies in place that are anti-Semitic. This is just outrage over a war that they feel that the country that they currently reside in, the United States of America, is not taking an appropriate stand. So I understand. And listen, all that being said, I am still very much a believer in the credo that is very as popularized in Israel, which is never again. And I think for any person in this country or any country you're in, you should be vigilant to make sure that there is not efforts at ethnic cleansing, that there's not efforts for laws to be in place that cause segregation. But I think to draw the comparison to that, to what's happening on the college campuses, is to say that what's happening in the college campuses is in and of itself an act of anti-Semitism. And that's where our paths crossways, and that's where our conversation goes in two different directions, because I don't necessarily think that's what's going on here. But again, if you are a Jewish person, or if you are a Jewish student, and that is the vibe you're getting from these kinds of protests, well, one, we'd like to have you comment on this video on YouTube, or you know, comment on our show, of course. But I would like to hear more about that, because as I hear the protesters talk about this, as I hear college professors who stand behind these students, such as at Emory University, that's not what everyone's sort of taking from this. And again, at the end of the day, this always comes back to this idea of to be against the IDF, to be against Prime Minister Netanyahu. Does that in and of itself make you an anti-Semite? I don't believe it does, but I'm not Jewish, so I would defer to my Jewish friends and those I'm close with, to their respective perspective on this.
Listen, we can't generalize what's happening across all these college campuses. We don't know the chance. We're not on the ground at some of these. I mean, I've been told about what has taken place at Rutgers University. It was mostly peaceful. No real big disruptions like what was covered at the University of Texas or at UCLA or stuff like that. So, and obviously the university already came to an agreement with these settlement camps or the encampment folks. And so all of that stuff has been cleared out now at Rutgers University, as you know, they got the list of demands and they're going to review them and stuff like that. So I don't want to belittle anybody's sentiments or feelings. Both things can be true. And by the way, you saw major protests, Nick, I don't know if you saw this, major protests happening in Israel over the weekend, you know, criticizing Bibi's government right now, criticizing the way that they're handling this operation. There are a lot of folks that are looking at this from a humanitarian perspective. And that's where Nick and I come from. We come from the humanitarian aspect of all of this. Wait, before you get to your one thing, because I do, I lost in the sauce here, as I like to say, is with all these campus protests has been the hilarity of some of these protesters protesting things and then wanting special treatment for the way they're protesting because they're without food and water. And if you haven't seen this viral clip about this Columbia PhD student that was out there on the steps of the campus meeting with reporters, and they were asking her questions like, what is it that you want the university to do now? And she responded like this.
First of all, we're saying that they're obligated to provide food to students who pay for a meal plan here.
But you mentioned that there was a request that food and water be brought in, unless I misunderstood.
To allow it to be brought in. I mean, well, I guess it's ultimately a question of what kind of community and obligation Columbia feels it has to its students. Do you want students to die of dehydration and starvation or get severely ill, even if they disagree with you? If the answer is no, then you should allow basic, I mean, it's crazy to say because we're on an Ivy League campus, but this is like basic humanitarian aid we're asking for. Like, could people please have a glass of water?
What's crazy is that all of that came out of your mouth and that somehow you got into Columbia University. That's the crazy part. I mean, let's be honest, like the fact that you literally went to go protest somewhere, and then you're there for like a couple of days with no supplies, right? And then you're asking the campus, which Nick and I have just told you extensively, has a code of conduct, and you are on, technically, you can walk on public grounds, but the university owns it, right? The university owns it. So they can expel the student. They can have people removed if you're disrupting, right? So you did all of this. You forgot your knapsack full of Mike and Ike's and wherever other snacks that you were going to bring, some Aquafina water. You forgot all of that. Now you want the university to help you because you will starve. And like I just mentioned, Columbia is in Manhattan. There's a deli around the corner. You can go grab some stuff from the campus. I mean, I found a little bit of hilarity in this situation. But the problem is, and as somebody pointed out to me, an immigration attorney who covers a lot of this stuff because of, you know, folks that are coming in from different countries. And she said to me, she goes, the problem is that everybody's running with that story. Everybody's running and focusing on that particular student. And my response is what I'm going to say here is, yeah, there's the problem, right? Because the revolution is televised and we got the wrong people that are out there in front of the camera talking about it because they don't have the media training, they don't have the common sense to say, maybe I shouldn't go complain in a first world country about supplies to a protest that I drove myself to. Like, this doesn't make any sense. Nick, what did you make of some of these different students? And again, it goes back to what I was saying before. 20-year-old Mike Leon is playing 20-year-old Nick Saveri in NHL 96, 97, or whatever game we used to play on Sega Genesis. Like, do you think that you and I had the mental capacity and wherewithal to be able to go out there and articulate why the Israeli government or why Rutgers University should divest from the Israeli government and whatever exchange programs we do or whatever monetary exchanges that we have? Do you think the two of us would have been capable enough to go out there and protest and really articulate why it is that we're doing this on our campus?
I mean, certainly not for me. I mean, the only political thing I remember, you know, of course, was the election of 2020. So, or sorry, of 2000. And, you know, we all felt the way we did about the outcome of it. And at the end of the day, it just fell into the hands of like the U.S. Supreme Court and, you know, what was going on in Florida. Do I feel that I would have been well read enough on that? I don't know. Obviously, there's more access to information now in the internet age. So I guess perhaps people are a little more, I don't necessarily know, informed or, yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily informed, but they certainly have access to more information. I laughed when I saw that clip of that student about asking for basic humanitarian rights. I'm sorry. I mean, if you're going to be about the protest life, then be about the protest life. If you are prepared to make your words felt, then I think it's the most absurd thing in the world to turn around and say, well, the people I'm protesting, I demand that you feed me. You have to think this one through. It's funny. You know, we talk about, I mean, we're talking about Rutgers and we're talking about
how this particular student has gotten a lot of attention. That story has gotten a lot of attention. And you were talking a moment ago about, or at least the attorney you're talking to is like, well, we're focusing on the wrong thing. I'm reminded, and I don't think I've ever told this story before, but I've certainly mentioned his name. Professor William Solomon at Rutgers University, who was the professor I took for my course on media history, which in many ways is the reason I, to this day, am very critical of televised news in the U.S. and actually around the world. So Professor Solomon tells this story that he was a protester in the 1960s. And if you ever met Professor Solomon, this would not surprise you. So he goes to a protest and, you know, there are some cameras there, not many, you know, so there's barely any media presence. And, you know, they're trying to make they're trying to make their words felt. And, you know, he goes home maybe a couple days later on the evening news. You know, they show maybe a split second of the protest he was in. And the network totally misconstrued what the protesters talked about. And, you know, then Bill Solomon sits there and just is stunned and is unhappy and doesn't understand why what they were doing wasn't important enough to really fully be explained on the television. And his father or his professor in college, someone said this to him, and it's never left me. But the adult told him, took him aside and said, look, the fact you're angry is understandable. The fact that you're surprised is absurd. The person then goes on to explain that with any media outlet, there is going to be an agenda. There's going to be a viewpoint, or there's going to be a perspective that is going to be represented by that network. And to think that what you're protesting, which in many ways flies in the face of all these companies and the government and the media, is going to get fully explained on television was laughable. That story's never left me. And I think I had that class in like 1999.
I mean, I think we got to end the segment on that, because that is really well said. Professor Solomon, big beard with the long hair, man. I remember it like it was yesterday. But look, if you attended these college protests and you're a kid out there, 18 to 21, you go to one of these schools, exercise your right to free speech, peaceful protests, continue to stand up and champion for things that you believe in. I'm totally on board with that. Obviously, no place for violence at these protests and stuff like that. But don't lose sight of, if you get a camera and a microphone put in front of your face, don't lose sight of why you're there. Think about what you're going to say before you say it. The reason why you're there is because you're speaking up for others that cannot speak up, including folks that are kidnapped right now, that are hostages as part of Hamas's terror attack on Israel, and also speak up for the Palestinians in Gaza, the innocent kids that have been killed in this conflict, the families that have been affected by all of this, even the World Central Kitchen folks that were killed trying to help get in aid. Don't lose sight of why you are there. The why is the most important thing. We leave it there. When we come back after the break, our buddy John Avlon, like I mentioned, he's running for Congress in New York's 1st District, former CNN analyst. He's going to tell us why he left television to make an impact for the greater good. John, when we come back after the break. This episode is presented by our friends over at SeatGeek, SeatGeek.com. Your next best night ever is waiting. SeatGeek's got the tickets, NBA, NHL playoffs, Major League Baseball in full swing, concerts out the wazoo, comedy shows, whatever you want to go to, SeatGeek has got you covered. Nick, did you finally use the promo code to head out to an event and get $20 off with our promo code?
It finally. I got a chance to check out the Phillies locally this year, so I was excited. It was awesome deal and got some great seats.
See, there you go. And I got to go to a Marlins game down here in Miami. If you live anywhere right now where an NBA team or NHL team is playing, you want to go see your team in action, do me a favor, download the SeatGeek app or go to SeatGeek.com right now. Put the tickets in the cart. When you get to checkout, enter in the promo code, Can We Please Talk, all one word. You're going to get $20 off that first purchase. Head over to SeatGeek.com or download the SeatGeek app today. Nick, today's episode is presented, as always, by our friends over at Fresh Roasted Coffee.
Since 2009, their passion has always been bringing you gourmet coffees from all over the world, roasted fresh to order. I got my coffee snob here, Nick Saveri. Nick, tell these people, coffee snob it up here. Tell these people why fresh roasted coffee is so good and why they're the official sponsor of Can We Please Talk?
You know, often the best cup of coffee that you're ever going to have is the one you can make from home. And you need good quality coffee to do that. And that's what fresh roasted coffee offers. You know, between single origin, between blends, flavors, anything on the coffee spectrum they've got. But more importantly, and I can't stress this enough, often when you purchase coffee, you don't know where to start. I mean, there's so many different varieties, so many different opportunities, so many different things you could choose from. And Fresh Roasted Coffee just gives you a very simple questionnaire and just says, hey, figure out what your coffee cup is. Figure out what blend works for you. I've gotten some single origin recommendations, so has Mike, and that's influenced everything. And what they recommend, you can get in a Keurig cup, the way Mike takes it. You can take it in the way I do it, which is typically through a French press, or you can get it for a percolator. Whatever coffee machine you've got, they've got you covered. But more importantly, just a huge variety and a way to learn more about coffee itself.
And all of this is available at freshroastedcoffee.com on their site. One cup is all it takes to fall in love with fresh roasted coffee, but you get a discount for being a listener of Can We Please Talk. Enter in the promo code Can We Please Get 20 to get 20% off your first purchase. Head to freshroastedcoffee.com today. All right, as I've been doing more and more of the TV circuit on CNN and some other outlets, a while back, I got to do a political panel with our guest that's here. And, you know, at the time, he was a TV pundit. He was an author. He was a historian. His wife has a great show on PBS. So the man was all throughout TV punditry, you know, making his platform known and making political arguments. And then one day out of the blue, I find out he's running for Congress. And I'm like, what? Where? How? So we have him on the show here. My buddy, John Avalon, is joining us, author, historian, and now running for the congressional seat over in New York's first district up in Suffolk County. John, Mike, and Nick, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast with us.
Hey, man, my great pleasure. Good to see you.
Likewise. Good to see you. So, you know, let's start at a 30,000 foot overview. Maybe some of our listeners, let's say they don't watch CNN. OK, let's say they don't know Margaret. They don't watch PBS. Right. They haven't read any of your books about Lincoln and some of the great historical work. They didn't even know you were a speechwriter for Once Upon a Time, America's Mayor in Rudy Giuliani. So let's tell them at a 30,000 foot overview, John, why did you leave the television punditry world where you could make a dent and an impact like you were doing? And why run for Congress in New York?
Because I didn't think it was doing enough. And look, I get the joke, man, right? I mean, everyone in Congress seems like they want to be on TV. We got to do nothing Congress. And they say they'd rather be on TV. And so people aren't used to people leaving TV to enter public service. But that's just what I felt the times called for in my own life. I didn't think that offering opinions on cable news panels was enough. I've loved being a journalist for 20 years. I'm an editor-in-chief of the Daily Beast. Written thousands of columns at my Reality Check segment on CNN, did the morning show almost every day for close to 10 years. And I love my former colleagues at CNN. But this, I think, is one of those elections where our nation's on a knife edge. And if we get this right, we'll be fine. If we get this wrong, God help us. And I didn't want to look at my kids and say I could have done more when it mattered most. I'm the grandson of immigrants. And like a lot of immigrant families, we grew up pretty patriotic. You don't take America for granted. And the idea that we could see it run down on our watch, totally unacceptable to me. And so I think now's the time to sort of roll up your sleeves and do the hard thing and maybe the rare thing, but run for office, because that's what democracy requires sometimes, just citizens step up. And that's why I'm doing this.
John, if I were living where I used to live in Long Island and you were to win in this fall, you would be my elected representative.
Where'd you live?
I live in Huntington.
Oh, great. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when you think about that district in District 1 in Suffolk, obviously I have a little bit of exposure having lived there for a few years, but what are the needs of the community that just strike you? Like, if you're going to win this election and represent D1 in, you know, the great state of New York, what needs the community are you trying to serve?
Look, I think whenever you talk to folks, I mean, whether it's Northport, Greenport, anywhere here on Long Island, knock on doors. Democrats are really focused on the danger to Donald Trump. That's true. But the number one thing everybody says is the crisis of affordability. You know, this goes back to, this is bigger than just inflation, right? And increasingly, I think people are getting hip to the fact there might be a little bit of price gouging. Inflation's getting better, but it's not happening fast enough. They're fired up about abortion for sure, and Roe being taken away. And that's motivating a lot of folks. But affordability permeates everything. I mean, the average cost of a house here, as you probably well know, is nearly $700,000. Families have been here for generations, feel like their kids can't move here. And that creates, I think, both a crisis and opportunity. I think a lot of the frustration folks feel about democracy isn't just about Donald Trump. It's a sense that the system doesn't feel like it's working for them, particularly if they're in the middle class. Middle class made long up. Right. I mean, this is, this is fundamental. And it's not an accident to me or coincidence to me that the middle of our politics have been hollowed out at the same time that the middle of our economy has been hollowed out. And so I think you need to look cohesively about that. And there absolutely are things that government can do. And Democrats, frankly, have credibility doing in terms of focusing on rebuilding the middle class. A couple things I think we can do concretely right off the bat to address affordability. And then I can get into housing because I think housing is having a moment. People are talking about it in a way, in a more elevated, comprehensive way than we have in previous election cycles. But look, Donald Trump and the Republicans raised our taxes by taking away the state and local tax deduction. And what I think really is frustrating is they did it out of spite as part of a political stunt. And they may talk a good game about how they're going to go and try to repeal it, but let's get real. Republicans are never going to restore the state and local tax deduction because they're really invested in the red state, blue state divide. They like it. They see that as a feature, not a bug, but it's going to expire in 25. And if Democrats take the House and if we win New York one, we will take the House. This is an opportunity to restore that. And if you're a family of four in Smithtown, right, let's say your husband's a plumber and the wife's a school teacher and they've got two kids, worked with a CPA to run some numbers, that's almost $4,000 back in their pocket. And then if we can expand the child tax credit, which is another real priority, we did it for 1 year during COVID, cut child poverty in half. That almost doubles that. So that's real money in the pockets of working people and working families. And that's the kind of thing we can do to begin to restore faith. Housing is trickier, right? But you have first-time homebuyer loans. It's one thing we can do. We can ease the regulation around what's called ADUs, accessory dwelling units, so that basically families can stay together. Grandma and grandpa can live in a smaller unit in the back and it can be an intergenerational family, or you can rent it out for temporary workers. We need to improve transportation. That's a perennial problem here on Long Island. But these are basic concrete things we can do, and it's in all of our interest. We need to rebuild the middle class, which is getting squeezed and frankly screwed over for decades. And that's led a lot to the frustration that's, I think, been hijacked by folks on the right who redirect that frustration towards culture war grievance politics rather than looking at what we can actually do to make the American economy and the American family work again.
Very well said there, John. We can see why you're running for Congress. As somebody who used to be in the Smithtown Hop Hog area, I worked for HBO out there for years, for over a decade. So,
is that right? I didn't know that about you.
That's right. I worked at HBO for programming and planning and helped build the HBO Go, now Max experience. That's for another pod for another time, John. But I do want to get Nick focused on the constituents of Suffolk County. Let's zoom out a little bit more, because obviously we're going to focus a little bit towards the end here on the June 25th date that's coming up with the primary. But let's say you were to win and you get to the general in November, you win. Zoom out for us here with respect to House Democrats right now, Senate Democrats, the Democratic platform. You just touched on it a little bit about the messaging to people right now. Biden's in a huge reelection campaign cycle. You were talking about this on TV with the victories legislatively, but maybe Democrats are not communicating it properly. What do you think you would bring to the Democratic Party from that standpoint and being a messenger for them to talk about some of the things that they've been able to pass?
I think this is a fundamental issue. It's fine. I got in the race on February 21st, and that night I spoke at a Huntington Town Democratic Committee meeting. And Jay Jacobs, the chairman of the state party who's endorsed me, came to the meeting and was taking questions. And I was really impressed. He began the meeting by a moment of silence for Alexei Navalny and then took questions for around 40 minutes from Democratic Town Committee members. And one thing that they said that I've heard over and over again is a real frustration on the part of Democrats about our inability to message clearly, right? Democrats are always on defense, right? They're always responding to things. They're not on offense. And I think one of the things we learned from Tom Suozzi's special election win is not only that candidate quality matters, but also that messaging matters and leaning into issues that people actually care about, right? And I think too often Democrats sort of tiptoe around and they seem afraid of offending someone or something, and they don't speak clearly about the issues that people are concerned about. So we got to play offense, need to communicate clearly. And if there's not moral clarity and moral urgency around this election, then you don't have a pulse. I mean, let's not forget the larger stakes here, right? It's not just democracy versus autocracy at home and abroad, though that is the stakes. I mean, we saw it in the Supreme Court hearing last week. I mean, we have a president, and we've never in our history, I'm a historian, as you say, and I appreciate your co-host's books in the background. I've got a good Grant biography, the new MLK. I think I may even see Doris Kearns Goodwin's on leadership back there. This is one of those times where citizens have to step up. We have never in our history, we've been divided before, late 60s, the 1860s, God knows, my last book was on Lincoln. We've been through worse times before. We'll get through this, but we have never had a major party nominee campaign on an authoritarian platform, praising dictators at every step. And now asking the Supreme Court to grant blanket immunity that could involve assassination of political enemies, according to his own lawyer, while citing the Washington's farewell address, which I did write a book about. And that's a complete intentional misreading and gaslighting of the American people to try to cite that as a justification. This is a dangerous moment in our history. And I think people are hip to that. And so I think there's urgency to communicate the successes that have been placed. Some of the economic gains are just being felt. But this is no joke. And people got to wake up and not get lulled into a sense of moral equivalence or, oh, you know, everybody's bad. I mean, this ain't a time for that. It's all on the line. We got one big tent political party left in America that believes in bipartisanship. And that record shows it. The infrastructure bill, the CHIPS Act, on and on. Big bipartisan laws that were passed under Biden. 300 bipartisan bills passed between when Pelosi was speaker. And so that's a legacy of success. We got to communicate it clearly and play offense and just explain to people just very clearly the great danger we are in as a country. This is going to be trajectory defined. Right. I mean, there's a reason Vladimir Putin's sort of waiting to see what happens in the election before he makes a decision about Ukraine. I mean, democracies at home and abroad are hanging in the balance here. Don't get lulled into, don't get all fashionably pessimistic or cynical or thinking that somehow, you know, that your vote doesn't count or maybe everyone's rigged and keep your eye on the ball. Keep focused on the big picture. We're going to be judged by history in this. We're going to be judged what we do. This is on our watch.
John, you know, as you're now running for office, obviously, what's the learning curve been like to become an elected official? You're obviously coming from a world of media, an author. Now you step into a different universe and you're sort of learning in real time and getting ready for, you know, some major events coming up.
Yeah, I got to say, I have found it to be really invigorating. It's sort of true in life. If you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. And obviously, this is a very serious thing to do. It's not the easy path, but it feels like the right one. And I've learned so much. I mean, I've covered politics for cycle upon cycle as an editor in chief, as an anchor, as an analyst, as a columnist. And so, being the candidates is fascinatingly different. And it's a worthwhile perspective. And I think, honestly, look, democracy, democratic republics depend on people stepping up and doing this for a season of their life, right? I think it's a great experience for everyone. I love meeting folks and talking to them about their concerns and their priorities and what you learn and how, frankly, it's different than a lot of the lenses we use on the news. I've always believed we need to focus more on solutions, not just talking about problems. But, you know, the consultant class has its own sort of gravitational bias towards cookie cutter approaches. And I don't think that's what folks are looking for. I think we got to disrupt the system in terms of just people's frustration with the division and the dysfunction and the ability to call out extremes wherever they may be. You know, I mean, to me, it's just, you know, defend liberal values against illiberalism and to have a heart and to use a head and to offer, give people a sense of hope. That these we live in a country where we're ultimately responsible. We can improve things. It's not easy, but that's why we should talk about policies. People say, "Oh, don't talk about policies." People's eyes will glaze over. I think that's how you talk about policies, because you got to give people hope that things can get better. There are things we can do. We're not powerless. That's the whole point of a democracy, right? That's a whole not that can be a whole nother term for democracy. It's the we are not powerless form of government. We can make changes. But we need to build broad coalitions to do it. And I think that's one of the exciting things about this time. This is a time where we can build the broadest possible coalitions to defend democracy and defeat Donald Trump. And then when the fever breaks, to build a new kind of politics. Because most people understand that, you know, bipartisanship is how you get things done. It's just folks on the far right and who seem to think that bipartisanship's the problem. We know it's the solution. So this is one of those moments. And I'm really, for me, there feels total continuity between the work I was doing as a columnist, as a journalist, as an anchor and analyst, a historian, and this. This is just a new arena, but it feels good.
Well, let's get into some key dates here, John, because let's get into the arena. You got June 25th, a Tuesday coming up with the primaries happening out there. So if you're a registered voter out in Long Island, registered Democrat, you want to go vote for John out there. So, John, what's the plan over these next 2 months right now? As we're recording this, it's the end of April right now. What's your plan on the ground here for the next, you know, 8 weeks or so for voters out there? And then on the flip side, let me be pessimistic for a second here, my friend. What happens if you don't win? Because you just gave me the pump up speech of it's too important to not sit this out. Right. And you're doing your, and by the way, kudos to you for running for Congress and doing that and leaving the television world. I could not do it myself. I feel a little unintelligent listening to you talk. So I'm glad you're doing it and not me, my friend. But listen, what happens if we don't win in the June 25th primary? What's the next step for John Avlon?
Well, first of all, I believe we'll win. And you know, one of my favorite apocryphal Abraham Lincoln quotes is, I'm an optimist because I don't see the point in being anything else. But we got data to prove it. I mean, nothing's a done deal, and you should always run like you're behind. But in the first 40 days of this campaign, end of the first quarter, we raised $1.1 million. I think that's a measure of the enthusiasm and support. My launch video got 2.6 million views in 3 days. I think that's a measure of enthusiasm and support. We've gotten the support of 5 out of 8 town Democratic committees in the district. They never endorse in primaries. They have this time. My opponent has gotten none. We've gotten elected officials from the assembly to the county legislature. And so we've got a lot of support. We got to keep people fired up. We got to keep them motivated, thinking about this is, there's been a low level sense that, you know, without getting too local politics, that, oh, Long Island was going Republican, right? Because we had a bad cycle. I think if you understand what's been actually happening here on the ground, if you've been following politics locally, you know that's not inevitable. There are a couple of bad cycles, and don't over-index that. This district was held by Democrat Tim Bishop for 12 years before Lee Zeldin held it, for 8. Now you got a first-term Republican who's a Trump hugger, who's the first of the 18. There are 18 Republicans who represent a district Biden won. He's the first to endorse Donald Trump and did it full-throated and early. He mocked the bipartisan border security bill. He cheered when Roe v. Wade was overturned. He thinks we should lower the age to buy AR-15s. He's far too far right for the district. He also doesn't live in the district. He lives in Amityville. He can't even vote for himself. His congressman is a neighboring congressman, Andrew Garbarino. And he's never even held an in-person town hall as a member of Congress. So this is a fight I can't wait to have. This is the good fight. And I believe in being a happy warrior.
To that end, John, I appreciate you reminding us all where Amityville is, of course. You know, when you think about, though, I think something that many of us have observed with members of Congress is that, you know, there's a push to develop a national presence, you know, through social media, having an opinion on national issues that sometimes, whether your district is in line with that or not, may not necessarily be what drives a push for a form of branding. How do you envision working with people that potentially on, for the sake of television, may give off a certain persona, but, you know, in terms of just day-to-day work as members of Congress, put forward a totally different vibe?
Well, look, first of all, I believe democracy depends on reasoning together, right? And you don't have to agree on everything. Right? That's part of the idea of democracy itself. But we do have to agree on common facts. And that's what's so sinister about this particular era we're in, right? Because the idea of common facts has itself been assaulted, not just undermined, but outright assaulted, right? I mean, the fact that Trump is using an election lie as a litmus test for party loyalty and people who know better are falling for it, that's sinister. So don't think this is politics as usual. It's not. And as a former journalist, I also think that people are responsible for what they say when they have the microphone. You know, we all know people in media who say outrageous, polarizing things, right? They polarize for profit. And then they get off the mic and they say, well, you know, it's great for ratings. No, I don't really believe it. You know, maybe they praise Trump and then they diss him when they don't have the microphone. But they're misleading people. I think that is a total just dereliction of duty. And that's just people on who've got the microphone in media. So the bar should be even higher for people in Congress. I know we've gotten used to kind of making it lower. But that said, I absolutely understand you've got to work with reasonable Republicans. Politics should be about winning over the reasonable edge of the opposition. That's what's so great about a swing district. You know, they're less than 20% of congressional seats are swings. And I think those have the most exciting elections and the most representative outcomes. And I think it'll be responsive to the kind of politics we all say we want. And there are good Republicans and people of good faith. Many of them have been chased out of the Republican Party. I'm married to a Republican, not a Trumper, but a Republican. And so I think that's actually something to lean into, that we're not as divided as the extremes would suggest. To some extent, I think the Trumpists on the far right have given us a psychological lesson in what happens when a small number of people are very loud and they succeed in a polarized political environment in particular in intimidating people, either into falling in line or falling into silence. And what do? Then they hunt for heretics. They say, if anyone doesn't toe the party line, we chase them out of the party. God knows we've seen that. But that's where the opportunity for a broader coalition comes in. But yes, you work with people on the issues you can find agreement on. But right now we're having some people, there's disagreements about basic facts. There's disagreements about democracy. There's disagreements about whether we should stand up to authoritarian regimes invading our allies. So you got to take a hard line on that. But then you got to work with the people of good faith who are on different sides of different issues and find areas of common ground and build on. That's why I'm running as a common sense Democrat, right? That means something. You got to work and solve problems, and democracy depends on reasoning together. It has been from the various early days of the Republic. Perfect's not on the menu. We are imperfect people trying to form a more perfect union.
John, like we like to say here, some things are not R&D, they're right and wrong. And that's a tagline for the show. Before we let you go, John, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to put on your TV pundit hat for 1 second, because you touched upon it. You touched upon it in the beginning of this when you talked a little bit, you alluded to it a little bit about the Trump immunity case. And I remember you and friend of the show, Ellie Honig, having a back and forth about the 14th Amendment, Section 3. Will the Supreme Court, take Colorado's case and what they will do with that? Obviously, they ended up voting in former President Trump's favor on that. So I'm going to give you, unlike a casino, I'm going to give you a chance to double down here, because the immunity case, Nick and I have talked about it in recent episodes. Obviously, last week was oral arguments in front of the court. Some wild scenarios that are not plausible or should not be plausible in American in the Republic, but they were asked. And all of a sudden, you even had Amy Comey Barrett attacking the Trump attorney about, should a president have this type of immunity, whether it's a private act or an official act? What do you make of all this as a historian and now somebody removed from television punditry that used to be asked about this?
We need to wake the hell up. I mean, there's the danger that we get numb to all this. We have a former president's attorney basically saying that a president could be able to assassinate opponents or execute a coup, and that holding them, if we got rid of presidential immunity, that might be polarizing for the country. You know, what would be polarizing would be assassinating political opponents and executing a coup. Okay. You want to cite Washington's farewell address? I can go chapter and verse. Washington warned primarily about the dangers of what we would call hyperpartisanship, specifically because he said it would lead some individuals to achieve tyranny on the ruins of public liberty, and it leads occasionally to riots and insurrection. Guess what passages the Trump attorney did not quote? Okay. In the case of the 14th Amendment, Section 3, I come to this as someone who's written a book about Abraham Lincoln. If you're going to be an originalist and a textualist, then the people around the ratification of that debate, it was intended to be prospective, not just retrospective. While I don't think individual states should be able to bar people from the ballot, I think that's a terrible precedent. It is absolutely the case that if a president participates or gives aids or comfort to and a rebellion or insurrection, then they should, if they've taken an oath to uphold a federal office, any federal office, then they should be barred from holding office. Now, the question of how that is executed, we could disagree, and Ellie and I disagree about that. But the fact that we just act like what was written in the Constitution doesn't matter, doesn't apply, is itself a dangerous precedent. But the really dangerous precedent is one we're seeing argued right now about immunity. I mean, if people are little R Republicans, if they are concerned about allegedly executive power, if they care about originalism and textualism, as our conservative friends often do, then they wouldn't understand that the founding fathers debated extensively the dangers of a tyrannical executive. They formed an entire form of government to stop a tyrannical executive. The idea that Sam Alito and other folks were indulging questions that would create the capacity for a tyrannical executive is itself self-evidently insane and deeply dangerous. And don't get lulled into it. And God bless Amy Coney Barrett for calling that out. Let's hope we have a broad decision, because this is not the kind of conversation, particularly as unmoored from history and context as it was, that we should be sleeping on. And yet I think people get numb, they get exhausted, they tune it out. This is the worst possible time to be exhausted. This is the worst possible time to tune it out. That's what Liz Cheney calls sleepwalking to a dictatorship. And that's why I think we need to be wide awake in America right now.
That's the soundbite. That's why the man was on TV for so long. You can go to johnavalon.com and find out all about his run for Congress. If you want to donate there, if you live in New York's first congressional district, June 25th is the primary there. So go out there and vote your support for John. John, I can't thank you enough for hopping on the podcast. Continued success to you, my friend.
Please pleasure, stay safe. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
All right, our thank yous there to John Avalon. Like I mentioned, go to John, A-V-L-O-N. JohnAvalon.com. You can find out all about his run for Congress, Common Sense Democrat for Suffolk County. Click the donate button, click the Meet John button. He's going to be doing, obviously, some stuff in the community over the next 6 to 8 weeks. Like I mentioned, June 25th is a pivotal date out there because that's when the Democratic primaries will happen. A couple other candidates that are running for, you know, to represent the Democratic side before the November general. So again, if you live out there in Long Island in that area, Nick, I didn't know you lived out there in the Huntington area, and we'll talk about that in a sec, but I did not know that. And I worked out there for years because when I worked for HBO, we had an office in the city and we had an office over in Hoppog and Smithtown area. So we're both very familiar with that over there in Long Island, that area, and John's running for it. A lot of good stuff that he said there, you know, also the historian part of this, and I know you're probably going to touch a little bit on that because that's where you kind of, you know, get to nerd out a little bit. And but I think there's also this correlation of, like, you know, what's happening now, because it's easy to do. Let me give you my takeaways. It's easy to talk on TV about something that you feel strongly about. You add some data points in there, historical references like he has, but he was also a subject matter expert. Remember, I mentioned at the intro, he was a speechwriter for Rudy Giuliani. Think about that sentence right now. Think about where Rudy Giuliani is on the spectrum of what he mentioned in terms of characters that are in the MAGA universe, right? Do you think he'd be the speechwriter for Giuliani right now? No, he would not. So that evolution of politics right before his eyes, 23, 24 years, the person he used to work with, and now that's gone. Like, those people are not coming back into the fold anymore. So I thought that was interesting that he said, I'm sitting on the sidelines and I'm watching it. And I say, I can't sit here on the sidelines anymore. Like, I got to do something about it. How can I do something about it? This is where we happen to have a home. I can run for the seat there. What did you make of not only the interview, but, like, I think I alluded to it as I mentioned to him, I'm not running for District 25 here in Miami where I live, you know, in the West Kendall area. Like, I don't know if I would quit tomorrow doing all that and run for Congress and feel like I can make a difference, because I've said it before and I'll echo it here. If I haven't said it, I'll echo it here. It's easier sometimes to talk about the problem than it is to try to solve the problem, because solving the problem is a group project. And when you get to Congress, some people don't want to work in a group fashion. What'd you make of the interview and what John said overall?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I mean, I think anytime we've talked to someone who's making this move to run for public office, especially right now where Congress is, I'm always curious about, you know, what do you as the individual representative, how do you have a chance against what I would consider the AOC/MTG-ization, I guess, of Congress, where you have just people who seem to be oftentimes trying to just mug for the camera as opposed to doing the good work for their constituents. If we agree that Congress is broken or is just not functioning, what do you think as an elected official you can do to change that? You know, and you're a Yankee fan, so I'll use this example here. Obviously, I'm a Red Sox fan, but hopefully Red Sox Nation will give me a pass on this analogy. But if John sees himself as a culture person, someone who can really live by the credo of doing right by his constituents and be a model for others, then I get it. Similar to Jeter with the Yankees, you know, being a great player, but just really being the kind of teammate that people want to be around and being able to step up in the toughest of times and just leading by example. Again, this is ambitious for a potential freshman member of the House. But if the idea is like to not get in the fray of the social media back and forths and all the cartoonishness that we see in the most fringes of the left and the right, but just really to do right by D1 in Suffolk County, then I think he may be on the right track. And it does give me pause to maybe the answer to this is to do the good work and to not get and stay on the sidelines because of what is making things so difficult, but rather be a role model and do the tough stuff. And hopefully that pulls our attention as away from the more silliness of the Congress.
Yeah. I'm interested to see what happens. Like I said, June 25th is going to be a big date because obviously first he has to be the elected Democrat to represent the Democratic Party out there. He mentioned some of the endorsements that have never been done before that he's receiving. So kudos to him for, like I said, leaving, I wouldn't say a lap of luxury in terms of television and writing books, that's still work, but it's a different type of work right now. So kudos to John for doing that and stepping into public office. And we'll find out what happens in June and if he represents the Democratic Party out there in the November general election. If you want to check out the video portions of our interview with John or anybody else we've had on the show, head over to our YouTube channel, type in Can We Please Talk Podcast. We should pop right up. Audio podcast platforms, you know by now, Apple, Spotify, Google. Shout out to everybody that listens to us over on Good Pods. Follow us on social media. Email us, canwepleasetalkpodcast@gmail.com. Social media at Can We Please Talk Podcast on IG and TikTok. On Twitter at Can We Please Talk. We can't do it without each and every one of you that listens to this program, engages with us, and interviews like we just had with John. As always, I'm Mike Leon.
And I'm Nick Saberi.
We'll see everybody next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.